I'd like to welcome everyone to the final event in this year's Research Group on Constitutional Studies lecture series. The Research Group on Constitutional Studies brings together faculty, graduate students, and postdocs, and undergraduates of McGill who work in political theory and political philosophy, public law, jurisprudence, and constitutional law across a range of disciplines to study the foundations, the history, the meaning, and the workings of constitutional government and practice. The RGCS lecture series, now concluding its second year, is made possible by a generous gift from McGill from the Oria Foundation, aiming to bring into student and, in particular, undergraduate life exposure to leading researchers working on questions at the edge of inquiry about the institutions, principles, and values of a free society. As was true last year, this year we conclude the year's lecture series with a debate. Last year we heard from Matt Zielinski and Deborah Sachs on the moral limits of markets, in a very fine event that a number of people remarked upon afterwards. Took two people with very different moral starting points and rapidly reached quite a lot of consensus. Today, we will hear from two speakers who start from really strikingly similar normative and moral starting points, and I'm quite sure that consensus is not on the table.
Don't give up on them yet.
While this concludes the RGCS lecture series, there will be further events sponsored by RGCS before the end of the academic year. These are known, these can be made available on the RGCS Facebook page or web page. The next of them will be a lecture next Friday at 5 p.m. in Ferrier by Jason Sorens, a leading political scientist studying secession and a member of the Department of Government at Dartmouth University. For today, it is my great pleasure to welcome Kit Wellman and Chandra Kunkfus. Kit Wellman is professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy at Washington University of St. Louis, and he is a leading philosophical expert on questions of secession, nationality, and migration. Indeed, I think it's fair to say that he has pushed us to think more deeply and carefully about the interaction among those topics, in particular about how to think about rights of free secession and questions of migration, than anyone else in the field, an interaction that I think is of great interest where we stand. He is the author of A Theory of Secession, The Case for Political Self-Determination, co-authored with John Simmons, For and Against Is There a Duty to Obey the Law, co-authored with Andrew Altman, A Liberal Theory of International Justice, co-authored with Philip Cole, Debating the Ethics of Immigration, Is There a Right to Exclude, and the forthcoming from Oxford University Press, Liberal Rights and Responsibilities, Essays on Citizenship and Sovereignty. He has, in addition, published a wide range of important articles on questions ranging from secession to the right of punishment. Because I've known Chandran better and for longer, I trust Kit will forgive me if I say a few more words of introduction about Professor Chandran Kunkfus, who holds the chair in political theory at the London School of Economics. I've known Chandran Kunkfus since I was, well, about the median age of the people in this room. He has been my advisor for a year at the Australian Defence Force Academy in Canberra, and has provided support of many kinds that leaves me with a list of debts, personal, professional, and intellectual, that it would be tedious to enumerate, a list to which he's only added by agreeing to come see us today. He holds a BA in History and Political Science from the Australian National University and an MA in Politics from the University of New South Wales and a DPhil from Oxford. He's taught at the Royal Military College of Canberra, Oxford University, the Australian National University, and the University of New South Wales at the Australian Defence Force Academy, and the University of Utah, where he held the Neil Maxwell Chair in Political Theory before taking up his current position at LSE. He's a founding co-editor of the Journal of Political Philosophy. He's been awarded among other honors, the Centenary Medal for services to Australian society through the study of social and political theory, a kind of contribution that not enough countries really recognize with the awarding of medals and honors. His publications include two very important monographs, The Liberal Archipelago, A Theory of Diversity and Freedom, and Hayek and Modern Liberalism. His great personal vice, a willingness to shamelessly pun in front of other people and in public, contributes also to one of his great strengths as an academic, one that he never managed to teach me, which is a knack for the clever title. Some of these will be opaque to people who are not themselves students of political philosophy, but trust me, they're really funny to us. Multiculturalism as fairness, liberalism and multiculturalism, the politics of indifference. Some of them are more widely accessible, including E Pluribus Plurum, How to Fail to Get to Utopia, in spite of really trying, Anarcho-Multiculturalism, and my favorite, his response to Brian Berry's book against multiculturalism called The Life of Brian, or Now for Something Completely Different. That's two for one. Professor Kupfer and Wellman are here today to debate the question, should borders be open? Professor Kupfer will begin for the affirmative. They will each speak three times before the evening moves on to a time for question and answer for 20 minutes and 20 minutes, and then less time each time. That will leave us time for questions at the end. And once we've concluded, I'll ask you to join us in the adjoining room for our reception. Please join me in welcoming Chandra Kupatos and Kid Well.
So, Jacob, thank you very much for that very kind introduction and for taking up all my jokes. So, I'm sorry for the paltry number that remained. Thank you all for coming, incidentally, and thank you, Kit, for being willing to get beaten up in public. Very, very generous. No kick for a long time. I have to tell him that I've never lost a debate. This is also my first debate. So the question is what about open borders? And I'm going to defend the case for open borders. So the way I'm going to do it is first I'm going to say a little bit about what I mean by open borders, then turn to explain why I think the idea that a legitimate state has the right to control borders or limit immigration or movement is not actually an important right. And this is where I go most directly against Kit, given that his most important work on immigration has asserted the right of the state, if it's legitimate, to control immigration. Then I want to look at some considerations that have essentially counter-arguments to this view, and then I will respond to these and then make a final case for why I think, and this is the key to the claim I'm going to make today, that immigration controls are ultimately controls not just on immigrants but on citizens, and so a danger to freedom. This is the biggest reason why we should be in favor of open borders. So, to start with, what exactly are open borders? I'm going to make a distinction here between three different respects in which borders might be controlled. In the first respect, borders might be controlled because what we try to do is to restrict entry into a country or a state. That is to say, you might literally have people at the borders stopping them from coming in. Secondly, you might control your borders not so much by denying people entry, but limiting the extent to which they may participate in particular ways in society once they do enter. Most notably, to the extent that people are allowed to become members of the society from which they're potentially excluded. So here are these three categories, entry, participation, and membership. Now, I think that most countries are actually reasonably free when it comes to their borders, when it comes to entry. You can get in as a tourist in most
most places, women both career and career tricky. It's not hard to get to the United States or to Britain as a tourist. The real problem comes when you want to either get a job or if you want to become a member of the state. And I want to focus on this second category, really, participation, in particular getting a job, because I think that the way to open borders is not, in fact, to make it easier for tourists to come in. They can come in reasonably easy as it is. The key is to change what it is that they can do once they come in. And this is where the real restrictions arise. So opening borders does not mean necessarily more people coming in. It means a change to what people can do once they do come into a society. And what I want to suggest is that we should open borders by making it much easier for people to participate in the society in which they enter, but not necessarily make it much easier for them to become members. In the end, membership, I think, is something that a collective might legitimately want to control. I'm much more skeptical about the idea that they should be able to control participation in the society, and therefore also entry into the society, just physically speaking. So why should I be so skeptical about a society controlling participation in a society or entry into the society, but not membership? Well, the main reason is that what I'm going to deny is the right of the state or even of the demos that the state is supposed to represent or encompass to control its own citizens to the extent that it may rightly deny citizens that freedom to associate with whomsoever they choose. If a citizen wants to marry someone who's foreign-born or lives abroad, wants to hire such a person, wants to invite such a person to come and give a lecture on open borders, wants to invite such a person to come in and take part in a course, it seems to me that this is something that a citizen should be simply free to do. It's not something that's legitimately a part of the purpose of the state to restrict. This is a fairly common kind of argument made by liberals in general, but not about immigration. They make this argument, for example, with respect to immigration. Of course, the demos can control various aspects of the governing of a society, but religion, they typically argue, is something that you have a right to practice regardless of what others might think. I want to suggest to you that immigration falls into the same category. We should not accept the idea that the demos or the state has the right to restrict our association with other people. If we want to associate with foreigners because we want to make friends with them, we want to marry them, we want to employ them, we want to listen to them, we just want to have them sitting around in our house, this is something that we should be as free to do as we are free to go and worship in an Anglican or a Catholic church or in a synagogue. We should be as free to do that as we are free to choose which side of the bed to sleep on or what color clothing to wear, whether or not to show respect for your audience by wearing a tie or to turn up, you know, without any such sort of form of attire. We should be free to make fun of our opponents if we want to, and we should be free to invite whoever we want to into our own homes. Now, typically, people who are advocates of closed borders make an argument of the following sort. And a very famous anti-immigrant politician in Australia made exactly this argument, Pauline Hanson, about 15 years ago. She said, you should be able to invite whoever you want into your own home, and Australia is my home, and I want to be able to decide who comes into my home. Now, I think there's something to this. When it comes to your own home, you should be able to decide who comes in and who doesn't. But things get a little bit trickier if you have, for example, a wife or a husband. Now, do you think that you should have a veto? Well, maybe. I mean, this seems like, you know, a possible kind of arrangement. Supposing you have children. Well, children have no say in this. I'm pretty clear about that. Supposing it's a group house. Is it a good arrangement to have it such that everybody has a veto? Well, you could manage that, but that seems like it's not going to be a very nice place to live in. Supposing you're talking about an apartment complex, should the arrangement be that every household has a veto on who comes into the apartment complex or into the neighborhood? You could have such an arrangement, but I think the larger this collective gets, the more absurd the arrangement becomes. And when you get an association that's as large as the state, it seems to me that this is a very, very poor form of social organization. You should not be giving everybody a veto, or even the majority a veto on who you associate with. A much more sensible, humane, ethical form of relationship is to say, you invite people into your home, I'll invite people into mine, we can all surely live together and cooperate happily without having to give either any individual or the collective as a whole some sort of veto. Now, are there any counter arguments to this? Well, there are a number of obvious counter arguments that are raised all the time. And basically, I think all of them come down to arguments about third-party effects. Of course, you can bring people into your own home, but if the effect of bringing them into your own home is harm to other people, that surely has got to be taken into account. And I think that's reasonable. So then the question is, what are the harms that are being inflicted upon others, and are these serious enough? And what are the claims that third parties are making for their interests being secured, and are they reasonable? And here it seems to me that on the whole, the case for those who want to restrict immigration, restrict freedom of movement, or restrict who comes into the collective home are not strong. One of the most obvious arguments made is that, okay, this is going to affect the employment of people who come into the employment of those who are resident in the country already. They're going to be adversely affected by all these immigrants coming in, lowering wages, taking jobs, and so on. Now, here it seems to me there are two things that need to be said. First is, it seems to me that the empirical case is dubious. Most economists argue that either employment is marginally affected for the worse by immigrants coming in, others say it's marginally affected for the better. It seems to me it's pretty difficult to say exactly, but the differences are very, very small. But in any case, you don't need a lot of econometrics to see that it's not population increase that's doing the damage. Otherwise, we would have stopped having babies or not made any progress since the Stone Age. So I don't think this is a really serious consideration. But the more important thing is, I think, a point of principle. Why is it that even if there is this third-party effect on people, that this is a sufficient reason for me not to employ someone from outside? Why is it that you're obliged to take the interests of your fellow countrymen, your fellow residents, or the people in this very, very large apartment complex, and put these above your own interests? In this case, your interest in marrying the person you want, hiring the person you want, choosing who you want to associate with. It seems to me it's going to be a very, very serious harm that you're perpetrating. Whereas in this case, what you're really perpetrating is a kind of failure to further enhance some other people's interests by taking a hit yourself. I don't see that there's a very, very strong case that's been advanced here. On the whole, it seems to me that most of the arguments made in defense of restricting immigration on the grounds that this is harming the society that's taking in immigrants are, at best, dubious. The margins are very, very small, and in any case, it's not clear why it is that individuals wishing to associate with others are obliged to take the interests of their fellows in the same neighborhood more seriously than their own interests or the interests of others they may wish to benefit by their actions. Now, the other thing that I also want to express some skepticism about is the idea that when the state acts in order to limit immigration, And one of Kitt's, I think, most substantial arguments is that immigration is immigration control is justified to the extent that what it means is the collective, under a legitimate state, is controlling the movement of people for the benefit of the collective more generally. What I want to question is the very idea that this is, in fact, what the state does. Because how is, in fact, immigration control managed? It's managed by a set of institutions which ultimately serve not the interests of the collective as a whole, as if what happens is the state is made up of people who get together and discuss impartially what's for the good of everyone, and then make rational, thoughtful, well-considered judgments about, you know, what kind of policy to pursue. No, it seems to me that on the contrary, what happens is that powerful interests shape the way states behave, advantage particular segments of society, and they do this essentially in order to get elected. I don't want to point the blame at any one particular segment of society, but there are interests that are at work here and in conflict. Most obviously, businesses generally favor more open immigration because this lowers the prices of wages, and trade unions generally are more hostile to it because it does exactly that. These two interests conflict. They're not the only interests in play, but these two interests conflict. Government policy is a reflection of who wins in this particular battle in particular elections. So I think we should look very, very skeptically at the argument that says, look, what's going on here is an attempt to serve the public interest, and we should take seriously these restrictions on immigration because what they reflect is the real desire of the populace. But there is a different kind of interest that's also at stake, and that's often invoked, and I need to say something about this one as well. Because there are people who are worried not just about the economic impact of immigration, but who are worried about the cultural transformation that's brought about by an influx of people. Some people are unhappy about the fact that when new people come in, this transforms the society. It makes it into something different. And I think this is true. But I think a couple of things need to be noticed here. One is that while this may be the case, some people in society welcome this transformation, and others are worried, perhaps even afraid of this transformation. The obvious question to ask is, why should the concerns of those who don't want this transformation be taken more seriously? Why should they have a veto? Now, I could understand this better, perhaps, if the transformation in question was going to happen so quickly that everybody is going to find their lives suddenly very, very badly disrupted by that of a very few. But I don't think, for the most part, we're talking about this sort of a problem. The problem people are worried about when they express this worry is a transformation of the character, shape of society over a long period of time. Now, what I want to submit is this is something we should not be concerned about because we're actually divided on this question. Who is to answer this question about exactly what the society should look like in 20, 50, 100 years' time? And what I submit is that none of us should take an interest in this question. In fact, it's none of our business. Okay? What people will be like in the society in that time is a matter for the gods. Final point, I've only got a couple of minutes left. One other reason to worry about all of this is that in order to either control the current state of society by addressing questions of employment or to worry about more remote questions by worrying about questions of identity, if you want to control the movement of people, what you've got to control is not just what happens at the border when people march across a dotted line. What you've got to control is, in fact, your own citizens. Because the critical thing, as I said at the beginning, is not who crosses the border. The critical thing is what happens once they enter the society. What immigration controls try to do is not so much control literal movement. What they try to do is what people can do once they've entered a society. And the only way to control that is to control your own citizens. Because the problem is not those who are coming in, but the people inside who are inviting them, who are associating with them, who are employing them, who are making love to them, who are befriending them, who are helping them if they're sick, who are exploiting them, doing any of these things. They're the ones you're going to have to control. You're going to have to set up an extensive system of monitoring and surveillance of your own citizens if you are to maintain immigration controls. Oops, actually, I just realized we have done that. And I can actually tell you from personal experience, it's quite a thing. What immigration controls means is an extension of this. So ultimately, the case for open borders is not a case for removing the border guards and letting people in. It's ultimately a case for removing the guards who are guarding not us against the immigrants, but guarding us from ourselves. Thank you.
So I'd like to thank Jacob for inviting me. It's lovely to be back at McGill. Also my first debate, and I'm excited about it. It's a little awkward debating someone who, for whom you have so much personal fondness and someone that you respect so much intellectually. Chandra and I think, he and I agree on much more than we disagree, but there are real and important differences here. I'm going to, in the second iteration of our talks, try and highlight some of those differences. First, I want to just set out and provide a positive defense for what I think is a relatively stark claim, which is that states, or at least legitimate states, have the right to design and enforce exclusionary immigration policies. In fact, they can even, if they want, exclude refugees who are knocking on the door. Okay? So neither Chandra nor I means to defend the status quo. I think we both see it, I suspect, I know I do, as a moral abomination. Neither one of us is advocating closing borders. Where we differ is whether or not even legitimate states have the right. Is it their call to make? So to put it in terms of one of Chandra's comments, right? Ought I to wear a tie? Ought I to tuck in my shirt? Ought I to at least wear a less garish shirt? Probably in all three, right? So you can give good arguments. In my own case, I'm a school teacher trying to raise a family of four with one salary. Saw this shirt on sale for $25. I thought, you know what? It's hideous. That's why it's on the sale rack. But I bet if I cover it with a solid jacket, I'll get away with it. It'll be a splash of color. Probably didn't succeed. Okay? Now, these are issues about which reasonable people can disagree. But interestingly, I bet Chandra and I agree about a fundamental question. Whose call is it to make? Right? Even if he and I disagree about the merits of tucking in shirts, wearing ties, you know, muted colors versus more extravagant things, right? But we both think, at the end of the day, it's kid's call. He gets to dress himself, and there's something problematic if anyone tries to interfere with that, right? And so the question that we really disagree with, even though we start with a lot of the same normative building blocks, is whether it's the state's call to the state as a whole to design and enforce exclusionary immigration policies. And I want to argue for that based upon three basic premises. The first is that legitimate states are entitled to political self-determination. They have a right as a deontological matter to be self-determining. Second is that an integral component of self-determination is freedom of association. If you're denied freedom of association, then you're not fully self-determining. And then the third is that the right to freedom of association necessarily includes the right to refuse to associate with others. Okay? So using some of Chandran's examples, I think the second and third points can be made pretty quickly and pretty easily. The idea that freedom of association is an integral component of self-determination and that it includes the right to refuse to associate with prospective others. Okay? So take the question, for instance, about whom I should marry, if I'm going to marry, right? It seems like should be my call, right? Now, Chandran might be much wiser than I, right? This will probably be on full display in the next hour, right? And so he might actually be able to choose a better partner than I. And my life might go better if Chandran chooses a partner for me than if I bumble through it and choose a partner. But I think we all appreciate that I would not be self-determining if I didn't have the choice of whether to marry and whom to marry and to refuse someone even if Chandran selected her for me. Right? So there's a very important sense in which I would not be the author of my own life unless that was my call. Okay? And so these, I think, are quite intuitive notions, and I don't think that this is anything that Chandran and I would disagree about. Where it gets interesting, though, is whether you think legitimate states are entitled to political self-determination, and therefore whether they, as corporate political entities, have a right to freedom of association, which includes the right not to associate with others. Okay? So in my view, legitimate states do have this right. And the way I understand legitimacy is in functional terms. In particular, the reason I'm a statist rather than an anarchist is because I think we need states to perform the incredibly important function of protecting their constituents' human rights. So in my view, a state is legitimate just in case it satisfactorily protects the human rights of its constituents and respects the human rights of everybody else. Okay? So as long as you do that, right, then I think you're entitled to political self-determination. All right? Now, it's an interesting question, which states are legitimate, which are not. It seems to me that a country like Norway is a pretty paradigmatic case of a legitimate state. Okay? And that means it's entitled to political self-determination. All right? Who makes the call for Norway? The Norwegians. Right? And others have to respect that. So note, for instance, that Norway seceded from Sweden in, I think it was 1905. Sweden may still be bummed about the breakup, right? Sweden could come to them and say, it just hasn't been the same without you. Would you like to reunite, right? And the Norwegians say, let's think about this, right? They hold a plebiscite. They say, thanks, but no thanks. It's not you, it's us, right? Okay, do you think the Swedes have to respect that, or do you think it'd be permissible for them to forcibly annex Norway and create one country? My own view is that the Swedes have to respect Norway's independence, that Norway is entitled to political self-determination in virtue of its legitimacy, and that includes the right of freedom of association, and therefore includes the right to say, no, we prefer not to associate with you in this way. We associate with all kinds of ways, but we don't want to make one political membership with you, right? And just so it seems to me that the story that we would tell about any one of us being morally entitled to refuse to associate in terms of marriage with any other person, no matter how desperately she or he wanted to be married to you, applies to Norway. I'd say the same thing about the European Union. The European Union, licking his chops, would love to have Norway as a full member, right? And can invite Norway to be a full member. Norway has twice held plebiscites. Both cases decided not to join the European Union. Do you think it's okay for the European Union to say, well, you know, we're just being nice and asking if you wanted to. We don't really care whether you want to. We're going to forcibly include you in our union, right? I think not. I think it's Norway's call. Right? And that the Europeans would culpably disrespect the Norwegians, right, if they forcibly annexed Norway. Okay? But now look, it seems intuitive when we're talking about these big unions, what about an individual Swede or an individual European? I think the same logic applies. Right? Norway can say to any Swede who'd like to immigrate into Norway, become part of the political community, let's think about it. No, we decide we don't want you as part of our association. And they're morally entitled to do so. Any particular European who wants to join in Norway, it's Norway's call whether or not to let them into the political union. That's an integral component of their self-determination to which they're entitled as a legitimate state. Okay. All of that, I don't think is, you know, crazy. There's some difficult steps. You might question whether states or groups in general, the types of things that can have rights. I'll be happy to talk about that in Q&A. But the thing I want to emphasize is I'm not an absolutist about this right. I'm not an absolutist about anything. I do think there's a right, but I think this is a merely presumptive right, and it could be outweighed by any number of concerns. Okay? And what you might do is you might look at the world and see the horrific distributive injustice and think, okay, I get that there's a presumptive right of the Norwegians to exclude others, but people in sub-Saharan Africa are struggling so horrifically through no fault of their own, right? There are people that literally, no matter what they do, cannot make sure that their children have enough caloric intake, right, in order to mature, right? This seems to be an extremely demanding consideration of justice, and indeed, therefore, to create duties of distributive justice among the world's wealthy, like the Norwegians, right? And so if I'm going to say that the Norwegians' presumptive right to self-determination outweighs the urgency of these demands of justice, right, then it seems I'm just fetishizing self-determination. It's important, it's a value, but it's not the only value, right? And these others seem much more important. So how in the world could I claim that the Norwegian right to self-determination trumps these competing claims? I can't. I don't think it trumps. I think that there's no question that the Norwegians have I think, quite demanding and stringent duties of global distributive justice. I think these duties are restitutive, I think there are Samaritan duties, and there may even be relational egalitarian duties, right? So I think there are any number of ways you can claim that these duties exist, and they're extremely stringent, and that that Norway can't turn the back on the global poor. But this is important. It's not obvious to me that those duties can only be discharged in the currency of open borders, right? Certainly the Norwegians, it seems to me, have to do at least their fair share, and we can argue, depending on theories of distributive justice, about what exactly their fair share is. But we can acknowledge that they have their duty to do their fair share, but then say there are a number of ways in which they can fulfill that obligation. Right? So the Norwegians, it seems to me, are entitled to deliberate among themselves and say, what do you want to do? Do you want to open our borders? Maybe, in fact, go and get some of the most desperately poor, right, and bring them to Norway, right? And Norway has done a bit of this. There is a non-negligible Pakistani community in Oslo for precisely these reasons, okay? So the Norwegians might say, yes, that's what we want to do, right? But they might also say, you know what, no. We want to jealously protect our political membership, okay? Fine. I'm not advocating they do that. I'm not an advocate of closed borders, right? I'm just saying that if that's what they decide they want to do, then they damn well better help the poor, the global poor, where they are, right? So they've got to discharge their duties. So if the price tag, given the climate of global injustice for excluding outsiders, is helping the global poor where they are, right, in terms of aid, institutional assistance, and things like this. Now, I'm inclined to see, therefore, the duty to help the poor as a disjunctive duty. You can help them either by opening your borders or by helping the poor where they are. Some people think that actually if you're most worried about the global poor, okay, then you would prefer closing the doors and helping people where they are. Right? It's actually better for the global poor. The idea here, the worry is that if you just open borders, what's going to happen is those who are best off in the worst off societies, right, like the doctors, the nurses, and engineers, they're going to have the wherewithal to get from sub-Saharan Africa to Norway, and they're going to leave behind those who have no hope of migrating, right? And they're going to be even worse off, right? So what you ought to do is, if you really are concerned about the world's worst off people, is you ought to close the doors and then make a more concerted effort to help people where they are. Against this, people come back and say, whoa, you're forgetting about remittances, right? Remittances are enormously important. They dwarf foreign aid, right? And the way the world works, this is, in fact, the best way to go. So you don't be so quick to close your borders and presume that's the best way to help folks. Right? Against this, folks come back and say, no, if we know anything about long-term solutions to the global poor, it's that it's at least in part institutional. Right? The problem is the institutions. And the problem with doctors, nurses, and engineers leaving is not just that these societies desperately need people to minister to the sick and things like that. It's also that these are precisely the people who have the human capital and the inclination and the ability to create those types of institutions, right? And so it's a recipe for disaster if you have open borders. Okay, so these are interesting questions that developmental economists might debate. I'm not going to take a stand on that. For now, I'll just say, look, it seems to me it's a disjunctive duty. All right, and I'm not, I think, implausibly saying, oh, all I care about is self-determination, the world's poor don't mean anything, right? Not at all, right? It's not that self-determination is an absolute value, or it happens in this case to trump the needs of the global poor. It's just that it strikes me that these duties can be discharged in other terms. Now, I'm not the only one to make this move. Several others do, but where they typically make an exception is in the case of refugees. Right? You may be able to send food in a box. You may be able to send all kinds of things to foreign countries. But when people are being persecuted where they live, it doesn't seem as though you can send justice in a box. Right? And so that seems to be a case, if there are refugees knocking on your door, where a wealthy, well-oiled liberal democracy like Norway has no choice. It can't be disjunctive. They have no choice but to allow them to immigrate. Okay? Even here, I think that's wrong. Even here, I want to say that there is a disjunctive duty. Okay? You may well allow refugees in, right? And certainly you shouldn't return them immediately until you've secured refuge for them elsewhere. But there are other options, right? If the Norwegians really want to jealously protect their political membership that much, right, then they can find other countries. They can entice other countries to take these people and provide refuge for them. And I also think that they can go to these home countries and they can push the government aside and they can set up refuge for them there. Now, here you may smell a rat. You're like, whoa, Kit, I thought the whole idea behind this argument was supposed to be that states have a right to self-determination. So where do you get off thinking that Norway can go into some sub-Saharan African country, push the institutions aside, and set up a safe haven for people so that they have refuge in their home? Be careful. My claim is not that all de facto states have a right to political self-determination. My key normative claim is that legitimate states have a right to political self-determination, where a state is legitimate just in case it satisfactorily protects the human rights of its constituents. Any country which is home to a refugee problem is emphatically not performing the requisite functions for political legitimacy. Right? And therefore, it doesn't have a right to self-determination, and the regime has no right to complain if outsiders come, push them aside to try and protect people in their homeland. So if you want an example of this, think about Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist regime, a lot of people thought were on the verge of a genocidal campaign against the Kurds. Right? One thing that foreign countries could do, I think there's no question that the world's wealthy, empowered countries have a duty to these people. But that doesn't automatically translate into a duty to allow them to move permanently into one's country, which is what immigration is. Right? Instead, if they wanted to, they could go in, they could create a safe haven in northern Iraq, forcibly impose a no-fly zone, right, to ensure that the Kurds had refuge without moving. right? So as inhumane as it sounds initially, right, I stand by my claim that at least legitimate states, it seems to me, have a moral right to design and forcibly enforce its own immigration policies, even if this means excluding the world's poor or refugees. Thank you.
So I think the key is to try to find where the areas of disagreement between us, because obviously there's also much that we share. And I want to focus in my response to Kit on his argument about self-determination and raise some skeptical doubts about the basic, not just arguments that he's offered, but the position that he's presented. Now, what he suggested is that self-determination is a very, very important ethical consideration. Now, I agree with him to the extent that I don't think that what we should be doing or advocating is marching into other countries and, you know, forcing them to either adopt particular institutions or adopt particular policies. While I'm an advocate of open borders, I'm not an advocate of, for example, the UN trying to, you know, engineer or enforce, construct a system of international law in which borders are open in the way that, you know, I suggest they should be. It's not that I'm suggesting that in defending open borders, we should also be attacking the integrity of states. I'm not, in other words, arguing for a world in which there are no borders, because I'm accepting and I'm in favor of a world in which there are different jurisdictions. So my concern is with, you know, why these jurisdictions are warranted in closing their borders, and I want to suggest that they don't have this warrant. I think focusing on self-determination, however, is troubling, because what it does is it focuses on the self-determination of the collective. Okay? And what I want to raise is this very straightforward question: why should the self-determination of the collective take precedence over the self-determination of the individuals who comprise it? Because this, I think, is the real point of tension. You may have noticed that, you know, in my arguments, I presented the case for open borders by presenting it as an assault on the interests and rights of citizens, whereas Kit has emphasized the importance of granting the freedom or the right to control borders by emphasizing the claims to self-determination of the collective. Now, why should this collective be given this right? Okay, well, Kit's given you various reasons. I want to offer you some reasons to be skeptical about this. I think one reason to be very, very skeptical about this is that the states in question that defend the right to self-determination are, in fact, not even at their best associations of people who've come together voluntarily and set up institutions that are for their mutual and universal benefit. They are, on the contrary, the product of long histories, sometimes short ones, of elite conflicts which have resulted in the settlement of particular kinds of rules and institutions and systems, which on the whole tend to protect particular interests. So when you're advocating or defending the right of self-determination of such an institution or such a thing like the state against the claims of citizens, what you're in effect doing, I think, is defending the right of particular elites to control the institutions against the wishes and desires of at least some of the citizens. Now, in order to protect this, I think you've got to have some particularly good reasons. I suggested in the earlier remarks that I made that when these reasons are offered, they're typically reasons of either, you know, employment and welfare or national identity, and I suggested that these reasons on the whole don't stand up because typically societies are divided. People have different interests, they have different conceptions of identity. So putting the case for self-determination is really putting the case for some particular subset of that society being empowered to determine the identity or the interests or the shape of that society. Now, again, just to emphasize, I'm not suggesting that this, therefore, gives anyone outside a warrant for coming in and trying to transform these societies. I don't think it does. The problem is self-determination doesn't give that right to the people. What it does is it gives that right, ultimately, to an elite. And as I emphasized in my opening remarks, what it also then gives is greater and greater opportunity for those elites to actually control the population. Because in order to be self-determining in this way, what you've got to do is you've got to produce compliance in the population, which means you've got to monitor them, you've got to survey them, you've got to ensure that they're doing what they should be doing in their engagement with others. Their self-determination of citizens is the price that you pay for the self-determination of the collective. Now, it seems to me that this is a very, very peculiar way of advancing the cause of self-determination by emphasizing the self-determination of this institution over the self-determination of the people. Now, of course, you know, this isn't to say that you don't have to address then a serious problem that arises. If you have got a population that is divided about these questions, of course you've got to then set up institutions, mechanisms to address this. I'm not saying that, for example, just because you happen to be someone who's in favor of open borders within your society, that you should be able to do whatever you like, go against the law, go against the majority, if the majority people don't want to open the borders. But what I am saying is that the arguments for it, ethical, political, legal, are flimsy. So what I'm arguing for is that, you know, citizens within their states should be recognizing the virtues of open borders, advocating these. I'm not suggesting that they can simply flout the law or go against the concerns or the demands of their fellow citizens. Okay. But I'm trying to suggest that the arguments that have been made in defense of limiting the movement of people on the whole are not compelling arguments. Let me say a little bit about, you know, the latter part of Kit's discussion, which is one that's focused on a very important concern that most advocates of open borders have raised, and that is the worry that if you are an advocate of the right of states to limit movement, what you'll do is you'll end up harming third parties. And I think there's a lot to this. I mean, I think, you know, in the end, opening up borders will do far more to improve the welfare and the well-being of people everywhere. But, you know, leave that aside. The thing that strikes me most about this particular case, other than the, you know, the empirical facts of the matter about which is the best policy, is that when we take, say, something like the refugee case, what's always struck me as most significant is that states that could welcome refugees are, in fact, full of people who want to welcome refugees, who want to take on the burden, churches, private associations, individuals. They're willing to do this. Now, what an emphasis on the right of collective self-determination ultimately means is that what you've got to do is you've got to stop people doing what they think is their moral duty, okay, which is to help others. Now, of course, there are other considerations that have to be weighed in the balance, the interests, the concerns, the worries of, you know, other people living in this collective. But if you put so much weight on collective self-determination, it seems to me that what you're doing ultimately is you're denying the significance of individual self-determination, and what you're also doing is you're denying the possibility in many cases, such as this one, of people exercising that capacity for self-determination to do what they think is morally right. And this, I think, is very troubling and should be weighed in the balance.
Okay.
All right. Shout out. I'm going to try and clarify where we stand and the difference between us, and you shout out if I'm mischaracterizing your view.
You're mischaracterizing my view.
Good. With that out of the way,
now you can say what you want.
So Chandran and Kit both value self-determination. We both agree that freedom of association is an important component of that, and so we want to see that furthered. The difference is Chandran is going to say, yeah, but look, if you give freedom of association to the group, you thereby are denying the self-determination of the individual. You can't have it both ways. The individual is morally primary. It's the only thing of ultimate moral value, right? And so you better have a damn good story, right, before you can explain why we'd give it to the group. Because, you know, you can't give groups dominion over questions like this without stripping important rights and effective choices from the constituents of those groups. Okay, good. So that's where we are. So let me, I think he's absolutely right, and I think this is the tough choice. And I'm a staunch defender of individual self-determination, so this is not a move I make lightly. So let me say a few things about why I think it's plausible to think that in all kinds of realms, we should defer to the group, where the group has dominion over a decision, even though we should always bear in mind that means the individual is disempowered in a very important way. So first off, imagine with me the conversation at the end of this weekend when Chandran returns to his lovely wife, Debbie. Debbie says, Chandran, how was the trip? How was the debate? Oh, it was lovely. It was unseasonably warm. The debate was fun. I crushed Kit like a bug, but I think he'll be okay. Oh, no, you crushed him like a bug? Yeah, but his views are deplorable. He had it coming. Okay. But enough about me, Debbie. Tell me, how was your weekend? Oh, it was fine. I saw a movie. I did that yoga class. You know, the yoga instructor I really like stuff. Oh, and I adopted a child. And wait, what? You adopted a child? Right? So it seems to me, right, that Debbie wants to go to a movie, right, when Chandra's out of town? Debbie's call. Debbie wants to go take a yoga class when Chandra's out of town? Debbie's call. Debbie wants to adopt a child? It's not the type of thing that's her call to make unilaterally. Okay? When you're family, this seems to me quintessentially to be the type of decision that you make as a family, or in Chandran's view, as a couple, because the kid's got no rank, okay? So at the very least, right, they should be consulted. Now, cue to all the married people nodding your heads, how precisely to negotiate these difficult questions is very hard to figure out. No one married in here, okay? Or you have blissful relationships, unlike my wife and mine. Right, and so it seems to me that this is not the type of decision that she can make unilaterally. In this case, right, she might say, what the hell? I'm an individual. You know, why is the group, right? And we can tell a story about how she consented to the marriage and that changed things, or maybe it's not a consensual thing. Maybe it's living together and all kinds of stuff like that. But it seems to me you have to tell a moral story, but you can tell a moral story to explain why it's not her call to make unilaterally. And even though you appreciate that there's been a diminution of Debbie's autonomy, right, you still think, that's not the type of thing she can do on her own. Say, if you want another sort of domestic example, golf club, right? Over lunch, Chandran was saying, he must come to London. I belong to the best golf club, right? I'll invite you in as a member, right? And the rest of the members of his golf club get one look at me with my garish shirts, they're going to be like, oh, hell no. Come on, Chandran. Those are not the types of decisions you can make unilaterally, right? If you want some bozo like Kit to join the golf club, by all means, nominate him, right? And then we'll decide as a collective, right? And similarly, there's probably nobody in there who has the unilateral, it depends on the rules, right? But that no one has the unilateral right to veto me, right? Anyone who dresses like that should not be out on the golf course with me, okay? So these are things that we do all the time, Right? Now turn to a state. Right? The reason why the most fundamental, difficult question in political philosophy is the statism anarchism question is because people who thought about it and who really value individual self-determination recognize that it's very hard to square individual self-determination with existing states, given that states have not garnered the morally valid, existing states have not garnered the morally valid consent of all their constituents, right? So in the case of a marriage, right, we can look at the wedding vows, right? Maybe Debbie had in her wedding vows, right? One condition of this union is that I will have sole dominion over all adoption decisions, right? Fine, right? Probably didn't. Same thing with golf clubs, right? These are things that are voluntarily joined into. States are not, okay? And therefore, once I start talking about political self-determination and reserving rights for states, you have every justification for being more suspicious and being, well, I'm not so sure. Okay. But let me talk about a few things in the political realm where it seems that I'm guessing most of you not be anarchists and would appreciate that it's the state's call, right? So walking home from the debate, right, tonight, and Chandra not satisfied with having humiliated me and embarrassed me intellectually, also wants to beat the snot out of me. So he just punches me, right? Right? Leaves me in the gutter and goes off to dinner with Jacob. May I exact revenge? Right? May I decide what type of punishment? Or does the authorities here have dominion over this? Right? It seems to me that even though, right, I have no contractual, actually I may, I don't know what I signed when I came into the country. Let's suppose, even though I have no historical record of surrendering my autonomy, right, it seems to me that the Canadian authorities have dominion over the criminal legal process in the territory here, and I have to defer to them, even if I think they're under-punishing Chandran or not pursuing things, stuff like this. Right? So if anybody, unless you're an anarchist, right, you have to appreciate that with at least legitimate states, it's the state's call. Okay? So you might say, fine, I'm not denying that, I'm not an anarchist. I'm just saying when it comes to freedom of association, there we have to go with the individual rather than the state. Say, really? Go back to some of the examples. Right? When Norway decided to secede from Sweden in 1905. They held a plebiscite, right? And I think there were fewer than 200 Norwegians who voted to remain part of Sweden, right? Does anybody think that, okay, unless it's unanimous, right, because every individual Norwegian has the right to veto the political divorce? No. When it comes to political self-determination, it seems like the group as a whole should decide. Now, I appreciate Chandran's concerns about existing states and how plutocratic they are, and they're certainly far from the democratic ideal, right? But I don't think that those are so worrisome that we'd say, okay, well, it wasn't unanimous in Norway, so they couldn't secede. Or what if when Sweden, in my hypothetical, comes to Norway and says, we want you back? If one individual says, yeah, let's do it. Do we say we have to do it? Otherwise, we're wronging this individual, because when it comes to freedom of association, we always defer to the individual rather than the political collective? No. Right? One last example. The reunification of East and West Germany. Whose call is that? Well, it seems to me it's East Germany and West Germany as a whole. Right? Now, I would hope that the deliberation is open and thoughtful and the elections are free and fair in the plebiscite, right? And we should certainly take Chandran's advice and strive to make things even more democratically impeccable, right? But it seems to me that no individual East or West German has the right to unilaterally say, yes, we're going to reunite. Nor does any individual East or West German have the right to veto it and say, no, we're going to stay separate. When it comes to political self-determination questions like that, the group as a whole decides. And if that's true, why should it be any different with respect to immigration? How much time I got?
2 minutes.
2 minutes. All right. So, but I think there may be one exception. Now, I do think that it's important to notice two things. One is that if Chandran wants to invite people into his house, if he wants to invite people to come work for him and things like that, nothing about my argument allows me to explain why he may not do so. My argument depends upon political self-determination and political membership. Someone can come for a temporary time, for a visit, right, and not be political members. My own view as a relational egalitarian is that if you invite someone to come and stay indefinitely, then you must include her in the political membership. And since the group as a whole has a right over political membership, the right as a whole should have dominion over decisions for people who come and stay indefinitely. But that's different from grandmama's visit. That's different from someone who goes to see a physician in London. It's also different from someone who goes, I think, to take a professorial role for 6 months in London. Where exactly draw the line? I don't know. Okay, but for virtually everything, it comes to indefinite things. And that's why I defer to the state. And the one exception is going to be, it seems to me, with family reunification. Right? If Chandran and Debbie are on different sides of a political border, right, it's not enough for the state to say, we prevail in all matters of freedom of association, she can't come and be together indefinitely. When you love someone, right, like you love your partner or a child or a parent, right, you don't just want to visit with them, you want to spend the rest of your life with them. And it seems to me that would be a case, even though I argued earlier that refugees would not provide a compelling counterexample to a state's right to exclude others. I think some matters of family reunification would. Thank you.
Well, let me take up this last example where you want to make the exception for family reunification because supposing you love someone. Now, let me imagine that I am a representative of the London School of Economics, and I want to invite someone to come and be a professor. And I say, you know, I realize that there are these immigration quotas that mean that we can't invite any more professors. But, you know, I just love this guy. I don't just love this guy, I actually am in love with this guy, and I want to invite him over because I'm going to marry him. Now, of course, the state is going to say, just hold on a minute, how come, you know, you're a serial marrier, and you always marry professors, and they always happen to be just the kind of person that you need? Well, of course it's got to ask that question, because as soon as you open up that particular opportunity, people will take advantage of it because they've got things that they want to do. So once you start controlling immigration, and this has been my main point, you've got to control people's lives to a much greater degree. You know, hence, you know, the extent to which governments monitor those who've got, you know, a desire for a green card. Go and see the Peter Weir film, Green Card, which, you know, gives you a funny sort of account of this, but it describes the extent to which bureaucracies, not just in the United States, but in Australia and in Britain and so on, you know, monitor people very, very closely to check their bona fides. But this is an inevitable consequence of having borders that are closed, because if you control immigrants, and you've got to control your own population. So this is the choice that you've got to make. And it seems to me that this is, in fact, a very, very troubling choice. Now, the other thing I want to say is that, you know, what Kit has emphasized in the early part of his last remarks is the importance of being free to choose who comes in as a member. Well, my concern is not membership, because I think that open borders is not about membership at all. You can open your borders to people's movement, to people's participation, without making them members. Take the European Union, for example. The states of that union have given up their right to control their borders with respect to everybody else in that union. Now, they don't seem to be particularly worried about the extent of their national self-determination, though some people are, to be fair.
Yeah.
And to the extent that that self-determination has been given up, it seems to me that they think that the price that the collective, whatever it may be, pays is worth the gain that the individuals have made. But you can give up that kind of capacity to control your borders without any great loss, and indeed by very, very great gains. So it seems to me that the argument for self-determination that Kitt is making ultimately doesn't speak to the real concerns that I've got. I may be willing to concede, you know, a little bit of value to self-determination, but what I would argue that we guard against is valuing it to the extent that he does, which I think is overvaluing it, overvaluing collective determination.
I'm not sure I have anything new to say. Let me just riff on the European Union example, right? Because I think it's a good one. I was surprised to hear you characterize the European Union and sort of offhand acknowledge that, well, there have been some concerns about political self-determination, because I think there have been enormous concerns by many of the countries about giving up the sovereignty, right? My own view is that these are not necessarily rational. My own view is that many of them are just xenophobic, and they're fueled by local politicians who are whipping up this xenophobia for short-term political gain and things like this. So I think that the European Union is a striking example for us in a couple of ways. One is, it's interesting to see that this move towards integration, which I think you and I would both want in the world. I think we both would like more porous borders, more integration, and we think things are going to go well. But notice, right, the way the European Union has worked has been in terms of countries deciding whether or not they want to do this. And these are difficult questions, right? So reasonable people can disagree about the extent to which they want their monetary policy tied to this larger unit, right? The extent to which they want their borders to be porous, and the extent to which they want to make sure that they have more or less control over what they regard as a special and especially valuable local culture, right? I think that there's room for people to disagree, economists to disagree about these things, political theorists to disagree about this stuff, but it's the legitimate states themselves who get to make the call, right? And so I think the European Union is a lovely example of where I hope we go as a practical matter, but also in terms of the way it's gone, in terms of proper respect for political self-determination. Thank you.
We have some time for discussion, and we hold the first question at these events for a member of the Research Group on Constitutional Studies Student Fellowship.
No pressure, though.
I have a question for Professor Wellman. On the one hand, you define legitimate states in terms of their respect for individual rights. You say states are legitimate insofar as they protect the individuals who live there. On the other hand, in the case of immigration, you say self-determination trumps individual rights. The state can control the individuals who live there by saying you can't associate with foreigners. Mm-hmm. I feel like it seems like if you think self-determination trumps individual rights, then you can't quite make judgments about the legitimacy of other states based on their respect for individual rights. I feel like maybe that poses a problem for your point about alternate solutions for refugees and the duties there.
Okay. So I'm not sure I fully understand the force of your objection, so I'll take a initial response and invite you to push back and say, no, that's not addressing my concern. So in my view, their legitimacy is a threshold thing. No state is going to ensure that is capable of ensuring that no human right is ever violated, right? So it's going to be a threshold, which I actually think is contextual, but we'll leave that to the side. But I think there is an objective answer to when that threshold is reached or not. And if you're above that, then you are legitimate. So I'm speculating that Norway is above that, right? I would speculate that current Somalia is below that as a failed state because it's not able to protect the human rights. And I would say Saddam Hussein's Iraq was below that because it was unwilling, if not also unable, to satisfactorily protect the human rights. Now, where precisely you draw the line, of course, we're going to have line drawing problems in all areas of philosophy, including political philosophy. But if that's right, then there's nothing inconsistent about saying those states that are above that line are morally, as a deontological matter, morally entitled to a type of respect that those below the line are not. And let me give you an analogy where it's equally hard to determine precisely where you draw the line. I think that Donna and I, because we're satisfactorily performing our parental responsibilities, have dominion, moral dominion over our children. And it's our call how to raise our 8-year-old and our 11-year-old boy. And you, as a principled matter, you may be you might have much better ideas about how to dress and all kinds of things like that, but it's not your call. It's Donna's and my call, whether they go to public school or private school, things like this. Not yours, even if you're an education expert and you know better. Okay? Why? Because as long as we're satisfactorily performing our parental functions, we're entitled to this. Now, if we were woefully neglectful or abusive, then by all means you could come in. And that's just to say they were not performing the requisite parental functions. Therefore, we don't have parental dominion. Therefore, you can come in. So if you're inclined to say that about parents and their children, as I suspect you are, why not say the same thing about political states entitled to political self-determination in virtue of satisfactorily performing the requisite political functions?
Catherine Lips.
Thank you very much. That was incredibly stimulating. I wanted to just clarify, what's at stake in your disagreements, and I'm wondering if the case of what we call illegal workers or undocumented workers or irregular migrants might actually expose the deep rift, I think, between your views. So I think according to Chandran, you're basically saying, individual employers should be able to decide who they hire. If it happens to be somebody from another country, the state shouldn't prohibit that. So this is the implication of an open borders policy, which is you won't have illegal migrants, who are working basically, right? So the state then will not have to have any regulation of people. They have other regulations, and for example, making sure people are being treated properly in terms of their rights and employee rights and so on. But they're not going to be there trying to find who's illegal and who's legal, and in terms of work, right? So now it seems to me that if you take the legitimate states view, however, you are committed to the idea that in fact there will be a category of people who are illegally working in one's country, right? And therefore you do in fact fall into, I think, Chandran's trap, which is that then you are forced to have to restrict your citizens' rights in some ways, because one very effective way of trying to stem illegal migration would be, for example, making fines on employers, right? Which is again a way to restrict your own citizens and their rights to employ people. So is he right about that, and is that the right implication for your view? And can you say something more specific then about why that is justified? Like, what would be the grounds of justification for that?
Good. So if I ever said that I can get political self-determination without restricting individual dominion, then I misspoke. I meant to openly acknowledge that Chandran's absolutely right, that you can't give the group dominion and still preserve the individual dominion, right? So I apologize if I misled. But I will speak to this in particular. So on my scenario, what I tried to concede towards the end is that if my argument today works, it shows only that individuals may not have dominion over inviting people in indefinitely. Okay? And so I'm going to be agnostic in terms of my arguments for today whether they might invite people in for a short stay, for instance, 4 months at LSE. Okay? But then we could still have problems, right? Because what he might do is he might say, come in, we'll say you're coming for 4 months, but you stay for the rest of your career. And at that point, right, it seems to me that the state has a legitimate concern about people staying indefinitely without having full political membership. And if I'm right that the group as a whole has dominion over who should be political members, then absolutely the state could come and wrap Chandra's knuckles based on my arguments for today, not because he invited me in, but because he invited me in for longer than the period.
Hi, my question is also for Professor Wellman. If I remember your theory of secession correctly, despite seeing self-determination as a right of the collective, you don't seem to take the group as intrinsically valuable. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on why.
Yes. So it seems to me the only thing that ultimately matters morally is, if we bracket for now other sentient beings, is individual human beings. I think groups are incredibly important, but they have derivative importance insofar as they add to or subtract from the lives of individual beings. Given that, then I owe a story of why I'm willing to say that we have principled reasons to respect a group rather than an individual. And the account I give, and to be honest, I think this is the weakest step, the most controversial step of my argument, the account is a functional one, right? And I, as I tried to motivate in the response to the first question, I think we see this with parental rights. It seems quite commonsensical to think that some people are entitled to respect in virtue of performing certain functions, like parental functions. So there's nothing, you know, ad hoc about running a parallel line when it comes to political self-determination. And I think you have to do that if, like me, and this is where I think Chandra and I are on the same page, if you think that these groups, that political groups, do not owe their membership to the free informed consent of the individual, so you can't tie a clear line from group self-determination to individual self-determination, and you think groups themselves don't have the same moral status as individuals.
Thank you. Very stimulating on part of both of you. Unfortunately, my question is also for Professor Wellman. I apologize for that. So I'd like to question how far you're willing to go in the refugee case. Because, so as far as I understand it, you're saying countries are allowed to refuse refugees entry, but they sort of have an obligation in some sense to either get other countries to allow the refugees in, mm-hmm. or to go into the illegitimate state mm-hmm. that the refugees are from, carve out some sort of safe haven, and ensure that they're safe there. Am I correct in that?
Yep.
All right. So global warming's happening, which means there are a lot of environmental refugees. Mm-hmm. And often it's not because the states that they're coming from are illegitimate in any way whatsoever. They're just really unfortunate in that all of their land is now arid or has no water or whatever. So it seems we can think of a state saying, well, we don't want to have these refugees come in. They try to convince all the other countries in the world to let them in. They all say no. Well, then it seems the only solution is to go and carve out the safe haven for them in an environment which can't be carved into a safe haven. So then, and so there are two parts to this. If they were to go in and carve out a safe haven, they would be stepping on the feet of a legitimate state mm-hmm. that's not at fault mm-hmm. for the refugees becoming refugees, mm-hmm. or they have to give up their right to say, we don't want refugees to come in, because there is no alternative. So it seems like environmental refugees might give you some sort of a sticking point.
Good. Yeah, I think that's an excellent example. So so my view is, take the United States, for instance, right? So as you guys all know, we all drive multiple large SUVs. In our defense, we need room for all of our handguns. But so this contributes to global warming. right, there's some other imperiled island population that is doing what it can, minding its own business, organizing itself in a relatively just way. Water is rising as ice in the world is melting because of exhaust from American SUVs. Okay? So it is on the Americans, right? So it's very clear the Americans are responsible for these refugees, right? So let's take that as built into the example. Now, you got to let them move there because there's no, there's, you know, they can't live there, all right? So this is going to sound fantastic, but I think it's the truth, right? So absolutely, the Americans have to provide refuge for these poor drowning folks. And the most obvious way is to say, sorry we sunk your island, come on in. If they're not going to do that, they better make sure they have refuge elsewhere. One thing they could do is they could transport a ton of dirt to the shrinking island, okay, as a logical possibility. Right? If they want to guard, I'm not an advocate of guarding your political membership, but if they want to guard it that jealously, right, then they can create more grand canyons, right, and transport that earth. Okay? Now that seems like they'd really be fetishizing self-determination. Another less descriptively implausible, but also logically possible, but less descriptively implausible, is they could say to a third country, let us entice you to take these people in and treat them reasonably well. What can we give you? Right? And as long as they know that they're going to be treated satisfactorily well, then they've discharged their duty. Okay? And so I would liken it, partial to domestic examples, as you guys are being clear, I would liken it to you opening up, there's a knock on the door tonight at 3 o'clock in the morning, you open the door, there's some baby there, right? Dear God, you can't just close the door and not do anything, right? But it doesn't follow from that that you have to adopt this baby, right? What you have to do is make sure that this baby has a decent opportunity to live a life, and that could be finding another adoptive home or an orphanage or things like that. And if there's some special connection between you and your previous behavior and the baby being there, well, then it's really on you to have that much more oversight and make sure that that baby's taken care of. But it doesn't automatically follow that you have to adopt and live with this baby in your home.
As time grows short, have any of the people who have signaled to me that they have a question for Professor Kukakis? I saw you earlier, so.
Thank you. Well, just a short word of thanks to both of you, and especially to Professor Kukakis, with whose thesis I'm generally in sympathy. How much of your thesis owes itself to Karl Popper and his Open Society? Does he make the explicit link between closed borders and, you know, a repressive state?
the honest answer is I don't know. I mean, I read Popper many years ago and have read it many times since. But I don't know enough about my own internal psychology to know how, you know, okay, this has all been transmuted into the truth that is now before you in my words. So, yeah, it'd be a guess. I mean, there's obviously a kind of affinity between the conception of the open society and the argument for open borders, but and perhaps more strikingly in the sense that, for me, the openness of the borders is not about the openness of the boundary. It's about the openness of the society inside. And so my worry about this tension between the collective and the individual being resolved in favor of the collective is what's, you know, at the core of my view. Can I just say one last thing, just to get clear about where I think Kit and I are differing, and you know where I think in one way our arguments haven't quite met. Kit keeps saying, you know, it's a matter. The question is whose call it is, and it's the state's call. And I'm in agreement with him to the extent that I want to say yes. If it's a choice between the state and say some external body, then the state makes the decision. The state, for example, decides in Saudi Arabia whether or not women get to drive. as opposed to the United States or the United Nations. But within Saudi Arabia, I think, you know, I would say to the Saudi government, no, you don't get to decide this. It's let the women decide whether they want to drive or not. It's not for you. And in that respect, I want to argue the state doesn't get to make the call. And I think Kit and I oddly enough, probably in agreement on both those propositions, where we haven't agreed. Is it, no?
No.
You think that the Saudi government does have the right to decide whether or not women drive?
I think they go hand in hand. So the threshold for legitimacy is going to be the same internal and external. Okay. And so if they have the right, they can they have the right and the, when they're facing their own constituents, and they have the right when they're facing external parties. If they lack the right, they lack the right for the very same reasons with respect to both internal and external parties.
Okay. So there's no asymmetry. Yeah. So that clears. Yeah. Hmm?